This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It has been a week that's seen South Korea use the upcoming Winter Games as a way to bring North Korea in from the cold. President Trump says he deserves some credit for those talks. We're not quite sure what he might make of a move by his French counterpart to make fake news illegal. But we do know what he thinks of El Salvador and Haiti and countries in Africa. Also, one of the BBC's top foreign correspondents quits her job, not just because she wasn't paid enough, but because she was not treated the same as her male co-workers.
I think it does speak to the depth of hunger for an equal, fair and transparent pay system. And the other thing I'd like to say is that what is lovely for me is that people are mentioning my China work, because I would not wish to be remembered forever as the woman who complained about money.
We'll talk more about the BBC's former China editor this hour. Here with us in studio to help us make sense of the news from around the world this week is David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. David, welcome to 1A.
Hello.
Jennifer Williams is Deputy Foreign Editor for Vox. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And David Sanger, National Security Correspondent for The New York Times and the author of Confront and Conceal and The Inheritance. David, welcome.
Great to be back with you.
We welcome your questions and comments about the week's top stories. And maybe to that end, I should add a little clarification about that word. NPR News has made the editorial decision that in this context, that word may appear on any number of NPR programs you hear today or in the days to come. You will hear that in this program once at the beginning, and then we will likely avoid it thereafter. If you choose to reference that word in your comments to us, we're not going to ban you from the show. 1A stands for First Amendment, after all, so that wouldn't look pretty good for us. So feel free to send your comments as you like. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page, where you can also watch our video stream, or tweet us at 1A. For my part, just speaking between you and me, I prefer the advice of Michelle Obama. When they go low, we go high. I believe that one can denounce behavior without having to demonstrate that behavior. So I will not be saying that word. And if you send us a comment that we read on the air, I'll just talk around that comment. But regardless of what you have to say, your comments are welcome. Jennifer Williams has agreed to be our designated potty mouth for the hour. And so, Jennifer, why don't you set up exactly what this comment was that came, as we discuss it, on the 8th anniversary of an earthquake that devastated Haiti. And President Trump tweeted that his language was tough about Haiti and El Salvador and certain nations, but the controversy began with a meeting that was reported on this week. Jennifer, what happened?
Right. So Donald Trump was meeting with members of Congress working on a deal related to the DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. And in the context of that meeting, he essentially referred to a number of African countries and Haiti as a, quote, shithole countries. So that is the comment heard around the world. And it's in the context of immigration, in the context of why do we have to take all of these people from these, quote, shithole countries? Why can't we take people from places like Norway? Was specifically the comment. And countries around the world, including some of the countries involved in those comments, as well as Norway, the United Nations, all sorts of people have denounced the comments as racist, as offensive.
Yeah, it was David Rennie. I was just going to ask you about that, your read of some of the international reaction to this reporting so far.
I think you're seeing already politicians like the mayor of London, who is a British Muslim, his father is of Pakistani heritage. He was actually commenting on the fact that Donald Trump has cancelled what was going to be a very difficult trip to open the new American embassy in London. The mayor of London, who is a Labour mayor, said that there would have been mass peaceful protests. I think you're seeing the British government very, very queasy. And that's in some ways an extraordinary achievement, because remember, the British Conservative government, they are the natural political allies of the Republicans. And also, given that we're now painfully trying to leave the European Union, we need all the friends that we can get. And so to manage to alienate and to make it politically painful to be close to Donald Trump for the Conservative government is a real achievement. The other thing that's so heartbreaking for Europeans, I think, is I was covering Europe based out of Brussels when Barack Obama won the nomination and then won the election. I can't tell you how many Europeans said, wow, That is the American dream, that this guy who's half Kenyan can get elected. We could never do that. You know, French people would say, we can't even have, you know, black African newsreaders on French TV. What an amazing place America is. And now, if you had to grow an American president in a laboratory to kind of offend and upset Europeans, you'd probably design Donald Trump.
David Sanger, what larger impacts, I wonder, does this comment or the reporting around this comment have? Crude, vile, for sure. Racist, no question. But in a more tangible sense, in terms of America's relationships with the rest of the world, other than the shock, does this actually move the needle at all, or is this just additional shock?
No, it's not even shocking, I think. You know, it was only a few weeks ago that the Times reported and the White House denied that in another conversation about Haiti and immigration, the president said something along the lines of, so everyone there has AIDS, why would we let them into the country? So this was just sort of another move along that line. And what was interesting is last night, the White House did not initially deny that the president said what this morning, after all of the uproar happened, he denied. So what's the impact? Well, a few things. First, there are many countries around the world who believe that the Trump administration simply does not want to deal with them and will not deal with them. And if they think there is now a category of nations that fall within the president's terminology, you know, we've got our allies, we've got state sponsors of terror over here, we've got occasional partners over here, and then we've got countries that fall into the president's new designation. Well, you know, that would actually make them begin to think, if we're not going to work with the United States and this administration doesn't want to work with us, who do we want to go work with? So if I was the Chinese and I was looking around for countries where I want to go develop new relationships, exploit natural resources, fill in the vacuum where the United States once was, get into some new regions, I think I'd start with the president's list.
Jennifer?
Yeah, I think it's really important also to note that there is currently no Haitian ambassador. So, you know, a lot of this is also kind of reflective of the chaos that Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, has kind of wrought in the State Department. So the charge d'affaires had to be the one. That's basically when there's no ambassador, you have the next kind of level person in that position who has to kind of go and represent. But the fact that there are missing ambassadors for a lot of these countries makes it exceptionally even more difficult because, you know, when these countries want to summon the ambassador to have them clarify, you know, on behalf of the U.S. government, on behalf of your president, are we one of those countries on your list? You don't even really have someone speaking on behalf of the president. You have, you know, kind of leftover career people who are the ones stuck doing it. So it makes it just even worse.
Wouldn't you have loved to have seen the cable traffic from the embassy saying, I have been called in for a demarche, a protest to explain the president's comments. Looking forward to the State Department guidance on how I do that.
Oh, my goodness.
Please forward soon.
Yeah. There's just kind of no easy way for this to go diplomatically. David?
So David is absolutely right that if you look at the countries that he's just insulted, clearly that's an opportunity for, say, China to jump in and say, you know, America has feet of clay. We always told you that they weren't on the moral high ground. There was no shining city on the hill, so deal with us. There are also costs for America's allies, the countries that he hasn't insulted. I mean, a country like Norway, whose prime minister was here and Donald Trump says, that's who we want. This goes down terribly in a place like Norway. And if you're the leader of an allied country, whether it's in Europe and you're trying to decide, should we spend more money on NATO, which means not spending so much money on schools and hospitals, if that becomes money for Donald Trump, the political cost of doing that just went up. If you're the South Korean president deciding whether to allow missile defense batteries that offend quite a lot of your public, and they're American missile defense batteries, in some intangible sense, every time Donald Trump puts himself out as this kind of thuggish bully, the political cost of working with America goes up.
We are speaking to David Rennie of The Economist, Jennifer Williams of Vox, and David Sanger of The New York Times on the Friday News Roundup. We'd love to hear from you about this or any of the big stories from around the world, particularly the Norway comments. Virginia emailed, regarding the president's comments on Norway, why would people want to leave Norway and come here? They have it much better where they are. High standard of living, excellent education, and health care. We welcome your comments. Email us, 1A at WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. By the way, I have heard, and I don't know if y'all know this better than I do before we have to pause, but as it relates to the visa lottery system, which was one of the core issues in terms of who we let in and who we let out and the criteria for that, I've been learning more in the last day about how well-educated people from African nations are, that the president's comments, and I don't know who could speak more to this, but are factually incorrect, that this assessment that if you come from an African nation, you, for example, lack education, we know that not to be true.
Yeah, they're seeing non-governmental groups putting out the statistic that the percentage of African migrants to America with college degrees is over 40%, which is considerably above, I think, the national average in the U.S. is 33% of native-born Americans have college degrees. So they're better educated on average. And that's the American genius, is to take the world's smartest and most ambitious, hardest-working people and turn them into Americans. And that's what's so tragic about Donald Trump's comments, is not that he's criticizing the countries they come from. Yeah, Haiti has a lot of problems. No one's denying that. But America's genius is to say, we don't care where you came from. If you have the moxie to get here, we'll turn you into Americans.
We'll get more into this as we continue with the Friday News Roundup. There's still news to discuss out of Iran. We'll get to North Korea and South Korea next. Plenty of stories out of Europe, particularly France, including France's efforts to criminalize fake news. We'll discuss that with David Rennie of The Economist, the other David, David Sanger of The New York Times, and Jennifer Williams of Vox.com. Looking forward to hearing from you, too. Email 1A at WAMU.org. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the global edition of the Friday News Roundup with Jennifer Williams, Deputy Foreign Editor for Vox, David Sanger, National Security Correspondent for The New York Times, David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief at The Economist, and with you. Share your questions and thoughts about the week's top stories from around the world. Comment on our Facebook page, where you can also watch our video stream. Tweet us at 1A or email 1A at WAMU.org. Gordon is in St. Paul, Minnesota. Gordon emailed, the president's reference was about countries, not people. The media talk frequently about failed states. This would be the politically correct way to refer to many countries such as Afghanistan, Syria, Zimbabwe, the Democratic Republic of Congo, El Salvador, Haiti, and many others. It is not racist to say that El Salvador or Haiti is a failed state, and it is not racist to use other phrases to describe the countries that do not function for many reasons, such as providing basic services.
I think that, you know, That's a valid point, that these countries that are being referred to, you know, do have their difficulties. But I think, you know, going to David's point earlier, you need to take this in the broader context of the way that Donald Trump has described actual people from these countries. So, again, saying that all Haitians have AIDS. He's talked about people coming from African countries saying, you know, once they come and see what America's like, they're never going to want to go back to their huts, which is just wildly offensive. I mean, this is the kind of language, if you're, you know, if your racist uncle at the Thanksgiving table was saying this, you would be horrified and, you know, try to get him to stop talking in front of grandma. But this is coming from the president of the United States. And it is about people. It is, when he's talking about, we want people coming from Norway, the subtext is now becoming text. He means white people. We want white people coming. We don't want the brown people coming from these countries. It's wildly racist.
David Sanger?
You know, we don't love doing history in this country, but what Donald Trump gave voice to yesterday has been a strain in American history that goes way back into the 1800s. My family came to this country from Germany at a time in the 1840s and the 1850s when Germany seemed pretty close to the definition of a failing state anyway, and a lot of religious persecution. And Americans were worried at that time about the influx of Germans. We had a period of time when a lot of Chinese came in to go work on building the Transcontinental Railroad. There was a huge amount of backlash against their immigration. They were regarded at the time to be of low education and so forth. Think now, a century later, about what our concerns are, you know, that Chinese are taking up, if you hear some people, too many slots at elite schools, right, for the opposite problem. We've had the same thing with Russian immigration. Donald Trump's family came in one of the waves of Irish immigration. And of course, there was backlash against that. So, you know, it would be useful if we stop and think for a moment about countries that we once regarded as places that you wouldn't want to let immigrants in from, that today we sort of say, what were we thinking?
And I think, David Rennie, maybe the other piece of it, just to follow on the comment that you were making earlier, is perhaps some of the gap in terms of the way that our presidency is viewed around the world. I mean, one of the countries that the president is referring to was the place of origin of the father of his predecessor. I mean, Kenya is an African country. So maybe part of this is just the vast gap between a president who was thoroughly meticulous about his words and someone who constantly needs explaining away. And now we have to explain away something that is baldly, flat-out racist.
Yeah, because the point is, if your listener was saying you can't criticize countries in Africa for having bad governments and stuff, if Donald Trump had said, I'm sick of sending military aid to these countries, that would be one thing. But what he was saying is, why do they keep wanting me to take people from those countries? And the genius of America is that this country realized quicker than a whole bunch of other countries that birthplace should not be your destiny, that it's who you are that should make your destiny, that if you turn up in town with the best idea and you're a stranger, America welcomes you. And that has been America's secret sauce since you threw off, you know, the King of England. And Donald Trump doesn't see it that way.
Let's move on to North Korea and South Korea. This week, North Korea announced that it will send a delegation of officials and athletes to the Winter Olympics in South Korea next month. That move came after the first high-level talks between the countries in more than 2 years. Both nations also agreed to hold military talks aimed at reducing animosity along their incredibly tense border and to, quote, actively cooperate in the Olympics, which open in Pyeongchang on February 9th. Jennifer Williams, this sounds like progress, isn't it?
Right. I mean, given the tensions that have been exceptionally high in ways that we really haven't seen in decades, even a small amount of progress, I think, counts as progress. I think one of the most interesting kind of small pieces that came out of that was that there's now still debate about whether the cheerleaders from North Korea and South Korea should perform as a single Korean unit at the Olympics or whether they should be separated. And I think it's a really interesting kind of lens into how North Korea sees South Korea. You know, they've long talked about reunification, about how, you know, the Korean people are all one. We want to, you know, reunify the Korean peninsula. And it also goes to the kind of broader point about alliance breaking, right? So, you know, in these talks, South Korea pushed to have the nuclear and ballistic missiles programs part of these talks. But they said, North Korea said no over and over, you know, we're not going to talk about that because it doesn't involve you, South Korea. This is about us and the United States. We're not threatening you, South Korea. Essentially trying to say, you know, we're family here. We're friends. It's the U.S. that's the problem. You need to kind of get away from them and come back to us. And it's a really just kind of interesting way of realizing the kind of more subtle dynamics that are at play here.
David Sanger, you and I talked about this earlier in the week, and I wonder if we should pick up on that point that Jennifer put down, particularly the role of the U.S. in all of this, whether this is kind of squeezing us out. I mean, the president spoke last weekend at Camp David, said the talks between North and South Korea were a start toward potential de-escalation. He also underlined how, in his view, his new tough stance had been important in bringing both sides together.
President Moon called me and we had a great discussion a couple of days ago and he thanked me very much and I hope it works out. I very much want to see it work out. So I'm behind that 100%. He actually thanked me. He said, and a lot of people have written that without my rhetoric and without my tough stance, and it's not just a stance. I mean, this is what has to be done, if it has to be done, that they wouldn't be talking about Olympics, that they wouldn't be talking right now.
That's President Trump speaking last weekend at Camp David. First of all, is there any credence to the idea that his rhetoric and tough stance made this happen? And then in a larger sense, is this North Korea-South Korea talk edging the U.S. out, or is this just one talk that we shouldn't extrapolate too much from?
I think that the president can make a pretty legitimate case that the combination of his rhetoric and, more importantly, the set of sanctions that he's now truly enforcing and has gotten increased in two resolutions at the United Nations has been part of the pressure that has caused the North Koreans to act now. I think it's a perfectly legitimate point. Now, how are the North Koreans doing it? They're doing it by trying to strip the South Koreans away from the U.S. alliance, an alliance that goes back some 70 years. I don't think that's going to work, but it is very canny in one way, Joshua, which is it would be very difficult for this administration to get the Chinese to agree to new sanctions, and it would be extremely difficult to get South Korea to agree to any kind of military action if there are conversations underway with the North, even if those talks have nothing to do with the nuclear program or the missile program, which is, of course, the heart of what this is all about. So if you're looking to buy time, and Kim Jong-un is looking to buy time, then it's a pretty good move.
David Rennie, what about the way that this makes the world look at North Korea? I mean, does this help to, for lack of a better word, normalize North Korea, make them seem like less of a threat, you know, another country that wants to win a medal at the Winter Games? Is this good PR for them?
I mean, it makes them look more willing to talk to anyone. And the panic a couple of months ago, if you went to talk to people at the Pentagon or the State Department, was that North Korea didn't seem to want to talk to anyone a couple of months ago. And so each new missile test was very, very alarming. So it's good to see them doing this. We don't want to get carried away. This is not the first Olympic Games that you have seen athletes from North and South Korea enter the opening ceremony under a kind of peace flag, if that's what they eventually do. We've seen this before, and it hasn't actually led to any major breakthroughs. They've competed to in Olympics and other international games several times. And then you tend to have the same debate in South Korea where conservatives who are very suspicious of this outreach, they say, well, hang on, we just heard that the South Korean government, for example, paid for all the uniforms for the North Koreans. So essentially, we kind of bribed them to come and be our friends. Hmm. What does that mean? And then you get the liberals saying, well, it's better than war. And so, you know, we've seen this before, but it's better than the total kind of silence that was really scaring people a month and a half, 2 months ago.
One more thing about North Korea before we move on, Jennifer. We read this week some reports that U.S. officials have been looking possibly at targeted airstrikes against North Korea, something that's been referred to as a bloody nose strategy. According to the Wall Street Journal, it would involve a targeted strike at a North Korean facility in response to a nuclear test or a missile test to kind of hint to the North what the potential consequences might be without leading to all-out war. Do we know anything more about that?
So the entire idea of the kind of bloody nose strike, in a sense of being, we can prove to the North Koreans that we are serious about our actions. A lot of experts feel like that is kind of a wildly irresponsible strategy. The North Koreans are already really convinced that all of our military operations, we do annual military exercises between the United States and South Korea to kind of show our power. We do overflights that go along the Korean Peninsula to show our power and our might. They're already convinced, the North Koreans, that this is preparation for some sort of invasion, for war. So the fact that we would, you know, do an actual attack, a strike, especially if it's preemptive, is Just in terms of escalating the situation, you don't know how the North Koreans are going to respond, right? It's a gamble. It's a risk. And given that they do have nuclear weapons technology, they do have ballistic missiles, they also have regular artillery that's already pointed at Seoul that could easily flatten Seoul, killing millions of people. Just doing that and hoping that the North Koreans don't respond is horrifying.
David Sanger?
I agree mostly with Jennifer. In nuclear theory, this is called maintaining something called escalation dominance, which is to say you always want to be in control of how this escalates. But the thought that's kicking around in the bloody nose theories here are not just to go do a preemptive strike on a missile that's sitting on the pad in North Korea. One theory is use your missile defenses to go after a missile after it's been launched over international waters. So at that moment, you are not actually striking in North Korean territory. The other is to escalate something that we revealed in March of last year that the United States was already doing, which was the use of cyber to try to go interfere with the strikes. And it worked for a while on a different missile design than the ones they're using now. Those would both be ways of doing this without necessarily getting on that escalation ladder that Jennifer referred to.
Let's continue with the Friday News Roundup with David Sanger of The New York Times, Jennifer Williams of Vox, and David Rennie of The Economist. Glad to see some of your comments about all of the stories going on, the biggest stories from around the world, including the story from the top of our conversation about the president's comments. Catherine emailed, "My husband and I are listening with such sadness and horror. Dear people of the world, you are appreciated by many of us. Trump speaks for himself from his own ignorant worldview, not for all citizens in the U.S. Another story we are watching today has to do with temporary waivers for U.S. sanctions against Iran as part of the Iran nuclear deal. Today is a key deadline for that renewal. David Sanger, let me stick with you for a second. President Trump reportedly was expected to stop short of reimposing strict sanctions on Iran. Do we have any sense of what his thought process has been? What's likely to happen today?
Yeah, sure. So the announcement today is supposed to come in the afternoon. And so the theory of this is that the president, for the third time in his presidency, after declaring during the campaign that he would kill off the Iran deal, will actually agree to continue the lifting of sanctions that was the U.S. side of that deal. Does he like doing this? No, he absolutely hates doing it. But his advisors have been pretty persuasive to him that if he fails to keep up the U.S. side of the deal, that would then free the Iranians to go back to doing what they were doing for years, which was enriching uranium, making plutonium, and being on the path to a nuclear weapons program. And so while he may not like the Iran deal for at least the next 8 or 10 years, it keeps the Iranians from ending up where the North Koreans are today. And I think the president, this is his kind of grudging way of acknowledging that. So how's he going to get around it? There's going to be a flurry of noise about new sanctions they're doing on Iran that are not related to the nuclear program. They're related to human rights violations. They're related to the protests that happened in the past few weeks. And those aren't covered by the deal. And he's hoping that his base will be satisfied by the thought that he can say he's getting out there and being tough on the Iranians.
David Rennie?
Joshua, this goes also right back to your point about how is Donald Trump seen by his allies in places like Europe. Remember that the original Iran nuclear deal brokered under Barack Obama's administration involved, you know, other world powers, the British, the French, the Germans, the Russians. And you have seen extraordinarily strong public on-the-record warnings from the British, French, and German governments, including ambassadors here in D.C., saying on the record in public, do not tear up this deal. Because if you think that America can walk away from this deal and we, the allies, will join you in a renegotiation, think again. We do not believe there's a better deal out there. And an amazingly interesting comment, the German ambassador during one of these kind of pushbacks said, and remember that the rest of the world is watching too. So if you walk away from the Iran deal when Iran is in compliance with the terms of the deal, what is North Korea going to make of that? Because if you're going to try and persuade the North Koreans that you can do a deal in good faith to stop their nuclear program, what message are you sending? So amazing pressure from the allies too.
I know we have to pause in a moment, but Jennifer, can you just remind us exactly what's happening on the ground in Iran? There was a reformist lawyer there who said this week that about 3,700 people have been arrested in the protests that are going on. What's happening briefly before we have to pause on the ground there?
Right. So in the past couple of weeks, we've seen these massive protests break out in cities across Iran. And it's mostly started out as economic protests over the rising cost of basic goods, eggs, milk, bread, things like that. They kind of broadened to be more against the regime and more broadly economic issues. But because of that, there was kind of some concern that Trump could potentially use that as cover, as political cover, to go harder against the Iranian regime.
We'll continue with the Friday News Roundup in just a moment. Still to come, we do have to discuss a reporter from the BBC News, a former China editor who made some headlines with her decision to quit the network, as well as another news story out of France. Everybody hates fake news. France's president seems to believe they can make it a crime. We'll get to that and more in just a moment. Stay close. Before we get back to the roundup, it is almost time for this year's first meeting of the 1A Movie Club. Each month, we review and discuss a new film, and this time, we're picking the movie Saturday Church. It's about a shy teenager who becomes the man of the house while discovering his gender identity.
What do you think is going to happen to him in this world? His father's dead. He's crying out for help.
I don't know why you're freaking out.
Mom and Dad told you not to wear Mom's clothes.
I won't do it again.
I'm Ebony.
Ulysses.
What kind of name is Ulysses?
I think it's kind of cool. I like it.
Where are you going?
Saturday Church. You want to come with?
Saturday Church debuts in theaters and on demand today. We will review the movie this coming Thursday, January 18th. If you go see it, send us a review. How many stars out of 5 would you rate the movie and why? Leave us your review by voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. We would also love to hear from you if you can relate to the struggles of LGBTQ youth, particularly those who end up rejected or on the streets. Share your story and your review on a scale of 5 stars, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212. We will review Saturday Church, spoilers and all, and share some of your stories and reviews this coming Thursday on 1A. Back now to the Friday News Roundup with David Rennie of The Economist, Jennifer Williams of Vox, and David Sanger of The New York Times. We'd love to hear from you. Email us, 1a@wamu.org. Before we continue, one story that broke just as we were doing the roundup here on the air. Reuters is reporting that the U.S. ambassador to Panama has resigned, telling the State Department he no longer feels he can serve under President Trump. According to an excerpt of his resignation letter read to Reuters, Mr. Feely wrote, quote, "As a junior foreign service officer, I signed an oath to serve faithfully the president and his administration in an apolitical fashion, even when I might not agree with certain policies." He continues to write, "My instructors made clear that if I believed I could not do that, I would be honor-bound to resign. That time has come," unquote. Now, a spokesperson from the State Department has confirmed Mr. Feely's departure, saying that he did inform the White House, the State Department, and the government of Panama that he will retire for personal reasons. That takes effect on March 9th. David Rennie, what's the impact of this? Do we know much about the U.S. ambassador to Panama?
Yeah, John Feely's a good man. I've met him. I've interviewed him. He's a serious Foreign Service officer. He was number 2 in the Mexican embassy in that role. He helped take down some serious drug lords working with DEA, the CIA, the FBI. This is not some kind of hand-wringing, you know, velvet pantalooned kind of foggy bottom type. This is a tough, rough, Spanish-speaking, loves Latin America, loves the United States diplomat of the sort that has really projected and helped America project power for decades. And to lose people of this caliber is just part of the story of the State Department losing some of its best people right now.
We've done a number of conversations about the State Department, by the way, including one that we had last year with NPR's diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. You'll find that if you search on our website, the1a.org. That's the word the number 1, the letter A, .org. All right, let's shift gears now and talk about the BBC. It is the world's largest broadcast news organization. This week, one of its best-known, most-respected foreign correspondents quit. Kerry Gracie found out that, like many other women at the Beeb, she was being paid far less for doing her job than her male counterparts. Now, the company apparently did offer her a raise before she quit, but her sudden resignation put more of a spotlight on the wider issue of gender disparity in the workplace. Here is some of what she told reporters outside the headquarters of the BBC in London.
Equal pay is very, very important to me. It's not about giving me a pay rise. It's about equality between men and women. And I thought I'd secured that when I went out to China. It was only in July that I discovered that I hadn't. So I've been trying to put it right. And I've come to the conclusion at this point that internal processes have failed.
That's Kerry Gracie speaking outside the London headquarters of the BBC. David Rennie, this is kind of the latest move in an ongoing saga about pay inside the broadcaster. Was this part of the larger kind of Me Too movement post-Harvey Weinstein? Did this start in another way? Like, how did we get to this point at the BBC?
So yes and no. I should say, for full disclosure, I know some of these people. I'm a British journalist. They're British journalists. I know some of the players in this personally. What happened basically was the British government, which is conservative and doesn't mind taking the odd swipe at the BBC, which is kind of like NPR. You know, if you're on the right, you tend to think it's basically a kind of bastion of liberal kind of journalists. Last year, they basically forced the BBC to publish a list of all of their journalists paid more than about $200,000 a year. Kerry Gracie, who is one of the foremost senior foreign correspondents, discovered that she wasn't on the list because she makes the equivalent of $182,000 a year as China editor, but that some of her colleagues, like the North America editor, the Middle East editor, they were on the list. And so she thought that this was outrageous. This isn't part of the Me Too thing in as much as the BBC is basically not a sexist organization. It's a very kind of well-meaning NPR-ish type broadcaster, but it is a story about star power and men kind of maybe being much more aggressive at kind of threatening to leave, go somewhere else, pushing up their salaries. And you're now seeing a big discussion in London about, for example, government ministers saying, well, hang on, why are our BBC journalists paid more than, say, the British ambassador to Washington? You know, how did that happen? And so you're seeing a kind of big discussion, but it's tying into that sort of sense of, even if an organization isn't kind of sexist, it's not Harvey Weinstein, are there more subtle forms of bias in which women end up left behind?
Jennifer Williams, I wonder what you make of the story, especially because, you know, unlike, say, NPR, which is mostly funded by listeners like you, the BBC is funded by tax dollars. It's one of these things where you pay a license fee and they can, you know, check up on you for paying your BBC license fee. And there's a larger bottom line issue of how our tax dollars are expressing a kind of gender bias.
Right, absolutely. You know, and I think, again, going to David's point about, you know, why are BBC reporters in general making this much money with our tax dollars? You know, there is the argument to be made that, you know, journalism should be funded very well. I personally, as a journalist, believe that. But, you know, I think it also goes to a broader kind of reckoning that we're seeing about, you know, gender wage gaps. You saw just a couple weeks ago, Norway announced this new kind of government policy where they're going to be cracking down on businesses and forcing businesses to establish these commissions to go in and look at companies and make sure that they are paying men and women equally and charging fines if they don't. So I do think, you know, beyond the kind of broader, you know, the London BBC media kind of environment, it is part of this broader reckoning we're seeing more.
David Rennie, let me come back to you for one second before we keep going. With regards to changing this at the BBC, now that these numbers have come out in terms of who's paid what, and now that Kerry Gracie is resigning or has resigned, whose hands is this in? Like, who has the power to set this right? And for that matter, what does right look like? Do you raise the pay of women to men? Do you lower people's pay in their future contracts? Like, this sounds principally easy. Like, of course, there should be gender parity, but in terms of the process of fixing it, whose hands is that in and where does that stand?
Well, the BBC is, as you say, funded by the taxpayer in a way, but is independent of government. So the BBC is now doing what the BBC does. And you have to, I love the BBC, but they are now tearing themselves to pieces in a kind of liberal self-hatred thing. And so literally, Kerry Gracie, who isn't actually leaving the BBC, she's quit her China job. The day that they were discussing on their main flagship news program, which is their equivalent to Morning Edition, whether she had been appallingly treated, she was actually the guest host of that program. So she was sitting in the studio listening to her colleagues discuss whether she had been appallingly treated as they all kind of pounded the BBC in the BBC's own studio. You're now seeing problems because some of the other top stars, very well-paid male journalists, were joking off-air about how maybe they could donate from their salaries to her to keep her at the BBC. That's now been leaked because someone else, the BBC, an engineer, thought it was outrageous. And so now they're busy groveling and apologizing for their bad sense of humor. So they'll sort it out, but, you know, they're tearing themselves to pieces in a very liberal way.
Another media story out of Europe that we should talk about has to do with the French president. He says he plans to introduce a law to ban fake news online during election campaigns. President Emmanuel Macron says he wants new legislation for social media platforms during election periods in order, quote, to protect democracy. The announcement was part of his New Year's speech to journalists at the Élysée Palace in Paris. David Sanger, this may sound maybe to an American audience fairly far-fetched, but Europe deals with social media very differently than the U.S. does. I wonder if you see it this way, but I don't see that this is entirely far-fetched. Like France, theoretically, they might be able to do this.
They might, because France is missing something we have. It's the 1A part of the program.
Exactly.
Here, okay.
Right.
So think about this.
Oh, by the way, David, I'm sorry. I'm glad you brought that up. I have recently learned that a lot of people don't understand where the name of our show comes from. 1A stands for First Amendment. I keep hearing people like, I thought the name of your show was stupid until I looked it up. And then I was like, huh, so that's where the name
comes
from.
Okay, well, there
anyway,
you go.
Go ahead, David.
I don't think it's stupid, Josh.
I appreciate that. Exactly. Go ahead.
So, you know, the First Amendment is actually what makes the United States different, wildly different constitutionally from other Western democracies, including some of our close allies. It's why I get to go publish things about national security issues that if David tried in Britain, where there's an Official Secrets Act, he'd run into a lot more troubles than I do, and I have run into my share of troubles. But in this particular case, what's fascinating about it is that President Macron believes that the French government can make a judgment about what is fake news and what is not. And if you tried this in the United States, people would say the First Amendment prohibits the government from coming in a prior restraint and determining what news is not going to get published. That is not a European view. The Germans have some similar legislation that actually just went into effect. There are other European countries that are discussing this. The difficulty comes here. We've gotten around this fake news debate by saying, let's let Facebook and Google make these decisions because they're not government entities, and they can make the decision on the basis of violations of the terms of service of their own organizations. In Europe, they're saying, we're not letting Facebook and Google handle this. We're going to do it ourselves. And I understand their instinct. I think it probably wouldn't be legal here.
David Rennie?
Just on a point of precision, that's all right, except that Macron's suggestion is that French judges, not the government, should declare that something is fake news, particularly during an election campaign. Doesn't mean that French journalists are not pushing back really hard, because they are. You'll see all the big papers like Le Monde, Le Figaro running these pieces saying this is a very dangerous slippery slope. But the idea is that a judge would decide in the heat of an election that something was fake news and that website should, if needs be closed down to prevent it spreading further.
But even judges in our system can't do this ahead of that. They can make a judgment that something was libelous after. But prior restraint is, you know, was decided in the Pentagon Papers.
Jennifer?
I do think it's important to note that, you know, they're talking in particular, especially about during sensitive election periods. And I think a lot of Americans probably don't understand, because, again, the very differences between our systems and theirs. In France already, there's a blanket kind of ban around like 48 to 72 hours, I think, before an election and during an election. So while people are actually voting, journalists can't say anything about the polls, who's going to the polls. You know, if there's even breaking news, some huge scandal about a political candidate that's being voted on right then, they can't report it.
Could you imagine that in the U.S.?
Right, exactly. I mean, it sounds like paradise in some cases. but, you know, and even regular citizens. Now, you know, whether the government would actually go in and, you know, arrest a citizen or, you know, fine a citizen for speaking out, but even making a political post on Facebook or Twitter during this election period. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that something like this during an election period would be somewhat more acceptable in France.
Let me stick with you, Jennifer, as we're low on time. I did want to ask you to tell us a little bit about what's happening in Tunisia. It's been a pretty rough week there. Human rights campaigners have accused authorities of an indiscriminate crackdown as the country is preparing for a weekend of what could be very big protests. More than 500 people have apparently been arrested and the army's been deployed. Briefly, Jennifer, what are they protesting against? What's going on?
So it's basically about economics, right? It's about economic austerity. It's about, you know, tax hikes, price hikes. But you have to remember, Tunisia was the birthplace of the Arab Spring, right? You know, we saw this kind of massive groundswell of protests back then and ended up toppling, you know, Ben Ali. And part of this is broader than economics, right? That's the basis. But more broadly, there's a sense that, you know, we toppled these elites. Like, we tried to have this kind of revolution, and things haven't necessarily gotten better, especially on the economic front. So there's a lot of anger still there. A lot of the protesters are younger, they're students, and they're kind of out there in part of this broader revolutionary spirit that happened back during the Arab Spring.
One last story we wanted to touch on, also out of France, before our time is up. Something of a battle has broken out between campaigners against sexual harassment and a group of prominent women who argue that overzealous misconduct allegations are threatening the country's embrace of sexual freedom and liberation. The movie star Catherine Deneuve was one of more than 100 French women who published a letter in the newspaper Le Monde defending the lustful advances of their male compatriots. One of the other signatories was the writer Anne-Elisabeth Moutet. She denounced what she saw as the binary and spiteful Me Too campaign that took root in the U.S.
This has become a kind of one-minute hate, or rather, I don't know how many minutes you have on social media, but that has really changed. And now the whole thing is where, you know, the Swedish government is saying that there should be written consent if you want to initiate a relationship with someone, and that way lies madness. You know, the idea that women are weak and feeble and we're shrinking violence and we need to be protected.
That was the writer Anne-Elisabeth Moutet. It's interesting, before we're out of time, I kind of see where they're coming from, this line between attraction and abuse, which is a thorny debate. But what about this? Are they kind of outliers? Do other French people feel the same as this, David?
There's been a big stink. You're seeing different groups of feminists, but this is some of them an older group of feminists who are very much defending their right to be kind of powerful women, but also objects of sexual desire. I mean, it's an amazing letter. They begin by saying, you know, what's wrong with la drague insistante, which means like really persistent flirting, or people like rubbing against you in the metro should be, you know, you just feel sorry for them. Literally, they mention that. They say you just feel sorry for these men. Part of it is about France having an argument about religion. They mentioned not wanting to empower religious extremists. So there's a bit of a kind of secular, kind of big city resistance to the idea of not just Christian, but also Islamic extremists, maybe trying to police mores. So that's all kind of feeding in, but it's turned into a gigantic fight.
Rubbing against you in the metro?
It happens.
If a guy rubs against me in the metro, he better run.
That's what it's called.
Me too.
He's going to the hospital. David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. David, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jennifer Williams, Deputy Foreign Editor for Vox. Thank you, Jennifer.
Always a pleasure.
And David Sanger, National Security Correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks, David.
Great to be back with you.
Do send us your reviews of Saturday Church on a scale of 1 to 5 stars, 855-236-1A1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.